It is super, super Election Tuesday, March 3rd. You're tuned into The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. Let me just say, it's the most gorgeous, gorgeous day in the neighborhood. It is perfect, perfect spring weather, but it's only March 3rd. And I just did a TV hit with NBC News, so it's it's an interesting day. As we begin the show, as we will do between now and November of 2020, we begin with the voice of Colonel Vindman. There's so much to talk about today, but Colonel Vindman is important, and it needs to be sort of born into your heart and your soul as you make a decision in the November election of 2020. We need to not only thank Colonel Vindman's father, we need to make sure that we thank the idea that we can actually exercise the franchise, and then we better use it.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful to my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Since our president doesn't value the truth, you are not fine for telling the truth. In fact, you're the enemy for telling the truth, which is why he attacks the media. It's going to be an interesting day on this radio show. All journalism, all the time. We're talking with an editor from ProPublica. Then we're talking with the Christian Science Monitor, Washington, D.C. editor. We're going to be looking at the challenges facing journalism, not only going forward, but under the Trump administration. All right. Today is Super Tuesday. So tell me what you're thinking as we approach a historic day, given the craziness of the last 72 hours, which has been really kind of interesting as well.
One thing that I'm thinking is I just can't believe the way the media couldn't wait to celebrate Joe Biden's one victory in however many years, decades of
Since Ronald Reagan.
It's like, oh, boy, yeah, he's electable. He won one election. I can't believe it. And then people are endorsing him like he was God's gift. What is that about? It's just crazy. Bernie Sanders really, he sounds loud and angry. But the fact is that the policies he advocates are similar to FDR's.
They're compassionate. They're responsive. They're responsive to people's fears and their needs.
But Bernie and Elizabeth Warren, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, these are FDR policies. Minimum wage, caring about working people. FDR got the Wagner Act so that unions could negotiate. That's what Elizabeth and Bernie are talking about the rich having all the power. You know, these are Democratic, core Democratic with a large D party and also small D democracy issues. These are not communist issues. These are not the other. These are our values, American values. And I just can't understand why people have this visceral feeling.
Because he uses two words that offend them, revolution and socialism. And they obsess about the word revolution. They resent the word revolution. Why would you want to revolt against us? I mean, aren't we perfect? Look what we did for you. We restored Wall Street. Oh, thank you. We gave you the Republican plan for health care. Oh, thank you. Oh, we still have the greatest gap between rich and poor. The rich love us. Oh, thank you. I mean, I just – so here's what I just said to NBC. Okay, so you just saw me taping that interview.
Yeah, so that's right.
Right. And so what I said to NBC was the following. I am glad that Bloomberg – and Warren are still in this race. Because the only thing that's holding up Joe Biden is everyone else but not Joe. All right? Joe has so far been so unsatisfying. He has been uneven in his performance. He's been uneven in his fundraising. He has been uneven in sort of discussing the issues of the day. He has been uneven in the language that he uses. He has been uneven in debates. The only thing that is saving him right now is Barack Obama, Jim Clyburn, and then the Democratic National Committee that basically probably begged everyone to sort of jump out of this race in order to support him. The question is, can this uneven older man who clearly there's a number age and then there's a performance age. He suffers not just from a number age, but from a performance age. When you look at Elizabeth Warren, they're not that different in age. But Elizabeth Warren exhibits the sort of the vitality of a 45-year-old, let alone what she is today. Bernie Sanders is kind of grumpy and I got some of the issues. I think he's more like 62. So I'm going to give him that. But Joe Biden is his age. And that's his performance style. And I don't know whether everyone around him that have created this moat of stability around him can carry him through the debates, can carry him through the primary, and can help him defeat Trump. This is such a challenge both for the candidate himself, Joe Biden, because I think in his heart of hearts he knows he didn't do this. He knows everyone else did. In the end, though, he will have to do it. And I'm not sure he has the capacity. That's why Bloomberg will be staying in this race. That's why Warren is staying in this race. Because Warren's theory to the election is that I am the only one that can thread those two sides together. I still believe in a compassionate capitalism, not socialism. I believe that we have to take on corruption. We don't have to call it revolution, but we can call it what it is, corruption and cronyism. And she can also sort of speak to, I think, the issues that the future really needs.
Right. Well, I've been saying this for months and months now. I think Elizabeth Warren is the archetypical, what we used to call liberal Democrat.
Yeah.
And now we call them, I guess, progressive Democrats, but it's the same thing. She's a liberal Democrat. Right. She's someone who supports the positions of the more compassionate part of the Democratic Party, the non-corporatist part of the Democratic Party that wants equality.
She's willing to challenge crony capitalism, which
right.
the Democratic Party unfortunately embraced. Let's
right.
be honest. They embraced crony capitalism. The Affordable Care Act, guess who got the most money from the insurance industry and the pharmaceutical industry who wrote the bill? The chairman of the Finance Committee, what's his name, from Montana, Max Baucus. Max Baucus was responsible for the Affordable Care Act. Why did the insurance companies get protected and Big Pharma get protected? Because they invested wisely in Max Baucus. That is crony capitalism.
Yeah, but Warren is really the person who, if it gets to be Bernie at the brokered convention and it's clear that Biden can't win and everybody's afraid of Bernie bringing people down, Elizabeth Warren has the liberal policy credentials. She's certainly smart and organized and competent enough to run the show, to manage a government and make that happen. And she is not turning people off the way Bernie is. People can listen to her and say, yes,
but I understand.
I like you.
I understand why they're staying in the race, because they're looking at I think, two individuals who have some real challenges going forward, and that's both Bernie and Biden. And it's interesting. It is also a function of their age. At some point, I'll share with you what I said about Chris Matthews.
But I would just want to say one thing about Biden. Biden had one good primary. Biden had one good speech. That's all.
I know.
All of his other performances have been horrible, both electorally and speaking-wise. And guess what? There's a lot more speaking in elections to come.
I know, I know. I'm done.
Don't jump on Biden.
They must be all lighting candles right now and going to church going, God, hold on to Biden. Make sure there aren't any more word salads. Make sure he doesn't slip. Make sure. I mean, that is the problem. Someone said to me, well, it's because he stutters. No. Please look at Joe Biden from 15 years ago, 20 years ago, and 25 years ago. It is not a function of his stuttering. Stop using that as your excuse.
Right.
That's not fair. Sure. He has functioned very well despite that. And that doesn't mean that I'm not sympathetic. The one thing I give to Joe Biden is that he and Mayor Pete are the best at empathy. They are phenomenal at empathy. I wish that that Bernie were better at empathy, and Bloomberg, he just buys empathy. Anyway, on that note, we're going to be joined by a fabulous writer at ProPublica. But before we do, I want to just share something from Andrew Cuomo from this morning, everyone. And I posted this on Facebook, but I want you to hear what Andrew Cuomo just did. I am announcing a new directive requiring New York health insurers to waive cost sharing associated with testing for coronavirus, including anything involving an emergency room, urgent care, and office visits. We can't let cost be a barrier to access to COVID-19 testing for any New Yorker. I expect to see this kind of an announcement and this kind of directive happening across the United States. This is now going to literally, I mean, we are connected, all 50 states. And I do hope that Andrew Cuomo's directive this morning, basically saying that all costs related to testing for COVID-19 will be waived by the insurance industry, is interesting. And as someone wrote, well, can we waive all costs now for my gallbladder? Can we waive all costs now for my heart, you know, heart stint or whatever? It's just very interesting. It speaks to the challenges for our healthcare system as we currently now look at it, which is, you know, copays, out-of-network, Medicaid, Medicare. I mean, it just looks like a piece of Swiss cheese. All right. So I am an avid reader of two places. I read TheConversation.com a lot, and I read ProPublica a lot because I value the information given and I value the people that write for them. And I was looking at ProPublica the other day, and I saw a story that was entitled The Real Story About Trump's Latest Attack on the Press. And this was last week. On Wednesday, President Trump filed – maybe it was even maybe 2 weeks ago. God, it just feels like – weeks feel like months now. President Trump filed a libel suit against the New York Times that should be readily dismissed. That hasn't stopped him from threatening to file more lawsuits soon. Joining me right now on the line is Richard Tofel. Richard was the founding general manager of ProPublica from 2007 to 2012, became its president on January 2013. He has responsibility for all of ProPublica's non-journalism operations, including communications, legal development, finance, yada, yada, yada. But more importantly, this is his history. He was the assistant publisher of the Wall Street Journal and earlier an assistant managing editor. You have a remarkable resume. I could go on for 5 minutes. But then I would lose hearing you talk about the New York Times and Donald Trump's lawsuit. Thank you for writing this. I just need to let you know, Richard, that this whole hour is being devoted to journalism. I'm going to be talking with you, and then I'm going to be talking with Washington bureau chief for the Christian Science Monitor about this conversation she had with two people from two different sources, Fox News and the New York Times, about how the challenges of really sort of covering this presidency and finding common ground and embracing the facts at a time where facts seem not to be valued. So welcome to the program.
Thank you, Arnie. Thanks for having me, and thanks for those very kind words about ProPublica.
Oh, it's amazing. So Donald Trump, I think, is the first sitting president ever to file a defamation lawsuit against a news organization. I just want to make sure that everyone understands there have been so many firsts with Donald Trump that, of course, this would be a first as well. So talk to me about what he was filing suit over. It seems like it was just in time for the statute of limitations to run out, so he obviously didn't express disgust when it was originally written. Tell us what it was that was written on the opinion pages, why he is filing a suit, and while the 8-page lawsuit seems to be almost an embarrassment for anyone to actually file with a court, but why not only should it not fly, but why it should frighten us anyway.
Yeah. So the lawsuit is about a piece that the New York Times ran almost a year ago, last March.
Right.
It was written by Max Frankel, who was in the late 70s and early 80s the head of the opinion pages of the Times, and then from the mid-80s to the mid-90s, the executive editor, so the head of the news pages of the Times.
Mm-hmm.
It was a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, and he's now 89 years old. And last year, he wrote an op-ed about the president and Putin. And he basically noted two things, that Putin has tried to help the president, which we know to be a fact. The government has recently confirmed that Putin is again trying to help the president mm-hmm. win an election, as he did last time, and that the president has consistently tried to go easy on Putin, sometimes without success. Sometimes he's faced opposition in his own administration, but he's had a pretty consistent record of trying to go easy on Putin with American policy. And what Max Frankel said was, this seems to me to indicate that whether there is an explicit quid pro quo, there is an implicit one, and that's all you need to know.
And the title of his piece, everyone, I just want to make sure if they want to go back and read the opinion piece. Let's remind everyone, this was not news. This was opinion. It was on the opinion page, which means, obviously, it is not necessarily reflect the opinion of the New York Times, but it is something that appeared on the Times page. The Real Trump-Russia Quid Pro Quo. And I think it was written a little bit right after the filing of the Mueller report. Wasn't it in part he was sort of responding to how Barr
That's
had
true.
Sort of twisted the Mueller report and put it through the Barr lens, as opposed to the lens of accuracy?
That's right. And anyway, the Supreme Court made very clear about 35 years ago that as a constitutional matter, opinion is fully protected under the First Amendment. So if someone is expressing an opinion, then their no libel suit is possible.
Right.
So this is a frivolous libel suit. And the president, no one from the president's campaign or the president himself or any representative complained at all to the New York Times when this was published.
Right.
Or on any day before they brought the suit, about a couple of weeks before the statute of limitations ran out. The statute of limitations for libel in New York State, where they brought this, is a year. And, you know, you might say, how do we know the president knows the law in this area, right? Maybe he just got angry and ordered somebody to file a lawsuit. Well, we know that because the president actually won a lawsuit in the very same court, the New York State Supreme
exactly.
Court, just 3 years ago on the grounds that something that he had said about somebody else was an expression of his opinion.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable.
And unfortunately, we also know that the president has a personal history of bringing libel litigation in bad faith.
Yes.
Normally, that it's very hard to prove that. And you might think, how could I be sure about that? And here's how I could be sure. In 2006, the president sued Tim O'Brien, a reporter, then for the New York Times, now for Bloomberg. Actually, he's on leave working on the Bloomberg campaign. But anyway, he sued this guy, Tim O'Brien, for a book about him for understating, principally for understating his net, allegedly understating
yes.
his net worth. And the president lost the case. Ultimately, he was deposed in the case, and it's actually one of the most important records we have about his finances is his deposition in this case. But some years later, he said to the Washington Post in an interview that he knew he couldn't win the lawsuit, and he brought it anyway to make a point.
Yeah.
These are his words. I spent a couple of bucks on legal fees, and they spent a whole lot more. I did it to make his life miserable, which I'm happy about.
Right. Right. But this is taking on a new level of toxicity because now he is president of the United States. And he has an incredible bully pulpit. And he has a following that are fanatical, that basically think that because you filed it, you must be right. Because you're accusing the New York Times of libel, you don't even need a court decision. He must be right. So even though we don't have seditious libel, although he would like that, they basically now have sort of, you know, quartered and come to conclusion because of who is saying it, the position that he does, and the idea that he wants to do this over and over again, which, if nothing else, might in fact chill future speech, which is what's so frightening.
Well, that's the last point's the important one. I mean, I'm not concerned about people who are prepared to accept the president's word for the idea that the earth is flat.
Yeah.
Because the earth isn't flat, and the vast majority of Americans, in my view at least, are not prepared to accept, you know, if the president says that. When the president says climate change is a hoax, the vast majority of Americans don't believe that. You know, time after time after time, the president asserts things are true, and the vast majority of Americans don't believe him. So that doesn't concern me, frankly, very much. What concerns me is the chill that he is trying to instill at the New York Times and elsewhere. This lawsuit was actually filed last Wednesday. Mm-hmm. So six days ago.
It was only last Wednesday. I wasn't sure. I'm almost afraid to ask, but you're right.
Yeah,
okay.
6 days ago. And God. You may remember that was the evening the president gave his first briefing on the virus. That sort of disastrous briefing that accelerated the decline in the stock market. And at that briefing, he was asked a number of questions that were not about the virus. And one of them was about this lawsuit. And he acknowledged the lawsuit and then said there will be more.
Yeah, I know.
And so what he's trying to do here is to get into the heads of editors and to say he's now officially become their adversary, in this case in a litigation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what he's trying to do is to hope that they will, you know, bend over backwards a little bit to establish their fairness to him, even though he's opposing them.
Well, so let me, there's a wonderful book by Tim Snyder called On Tyranny. And one of the first things that he writes in his book On Tyranny, it's this tiny little, you know, you can almost put it in your pocketbook, is that the idea of a little bit going to what you just said, which is that there are going to be more lawsuits, and that my concern is that people will begin to self-censor. That they will begin to sort of act saying, what if? Now, the New York Times is probably in the best position not to be frightened by that because they have deep pockets. They're wildly successful now, even compared to just a decade ago. And they can handle his attacks. I can't. I suspect ProPublica can't. I suspect a lot of people
can't. Well, luckily, I think we –
Okay.
I think we can.
Okay, good. But I can't. I mean, I'll be honest with you. Doesn't mean that I'm prepared to lose everything. I am. I'm a lunatic, okay? And I have had friends who call me and say, Arnie, you better be calm. You better, like, not say the truth, you know? And yet what I think is important is that in his book On Tyranny, he talks about the fact that what happens with authoritarians is that you begin to even cede them more power than they legitimately have. And the idea is that he wants to chill the freedom of speech, that he wants to chill the press. And as you and I both know, he doesn't have the legal grounds to do it. It is a violation of our First Amendment. But that doesn't matter because you, as he pointed out, I can sue you, you will be financially exhausted, and even if I lose, I won. And I think that's really what the fear is by what he is about to do, because I think, you know, what we saw on Wednesday will probably not be the first, because we watched him all through New York, and his entire time in New York City was litigation, 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 litigation. Ask every banker, ask every realtor, ask anyone that worked for him. And winning or losing is not the issue. The fact is he wants to threaten you with a lawsuit.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, you know, there is some record of that, and he had mostly blustered about the press until now. You know, he constantly, and as recently as a couple of days ago, again, uses the phrase enemy of the people. And, you know, people have gotten used to that phrase,
yeah.
But I think they need to take it more seriously. I've looked back into the origins of that phrase. It started with Robespierre in the French Revolution.
Yes.
Wow.
It was then picked up by Hitler and Stalin.
Mm-hmm.
And then most recently by Mazzucchelli. All four of those people, when they what they did ultimately with people they referred to as enemies of the people, they had them killed.
Wow.
And you know, the line is, when someone shows you who they are, you need to
believe them.
You need to recognize that. That is the origin of that phrase, and that is how it has ended throughout history. And I'm not saying that that's how it will end here, but that is a phrase with meaning both currently and historically.
Yes.
And I think we sometimes don't take it seriously enough.
So there was a comment on one of the articles I read about the New York Times, the lawsuit, and it was the following. I wrote my second-year thesis at the university in the UK on the rise of Hitler. These attacks on the press exactly echo those that I then detailed. Silencing criticism, silencing the press, is the first step to fascism. Trump is testing the waters here, seeing how far he can negate the First Amendment. America, I am truly terrified for you. If you do not decisively defeat him in November, I am generally concerned, deeply concerned, that the U.S., as a democratic republic, will be finished. So in a lot of ways, as you mentioned Robespierre and you went through all these things, I had seen that in your article at ProPublica, which I recommend everyone should read. It's at both my personal Facebook page as well as the Attitudes Facebook page. But we need to take him seriously. We have to take him seriously.
I will just say this. You know, we don't take partisan political positions, and I want to be careful not
to. That's my words, not yours. Like the opinion, that's my opinion.
But I will just say this. The president's been very clear on the question of libel law, that he wants to change the libel law in this country. He has said this for 5 years, and that he particularly wants to reinstitute, and you referred to it earlier, wants to reinstitute the law of seditious libel, which is to say that criticism of the government becomes illegal.
Yeah.
That was outlawed in this country at every level of government almost 100 years ago.
Yeah.
It was the law in Britain for a long time and the common law, and in the early years of this country, occasionally, the Congress passed the Alien and Sedition Acts at the end of the 18th century, but it has been clear since at least 1922 that no such action will stand under the Constitution of the United States, and Donald Trump has indicated more than once that he would like to change that.
Richard Toefel, I need to let you go. Thank you so much for working with ProPublica. I so value the work that you do and the work that ProPublica does. We need more and more investigative reporters. We need a robust press. We need a press that speaks truth to power. Truth is the operative word. The real story about Trump's latest attack on the press. We've been joined by Richard Toefel, who is the president of ProPublica. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure. All right, everyone. A little labor news is next. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1945. National headlines spread fear of the growing wildcat strikes at Chrysler and Briggs auto plants in Detroit. The wildcats had increased to 35,000 strikers and idled workers at 2 Chrysler plants and 7 Briggs plants. The strike wave started a week earlier at the Dodge main plant in Detroit. 8 of the union's best leaders had been discharged for refusing to go along with a production line speed up. Briggs management followed Chrysler's union busting campaign by firing 7 UAW officers at the Mack Avenue plant. 3 days later, Briggs fired another 8 committee men and stewards, which then provoked the walkout. Company officials and the War Labor Board were outraged at the halt in war production of tanks, B-29 Super Fortresses, anti-aircraft guns, rockets, and trucks. The Michigan legislature introduced a bill to define as a felony any strike participation that violated a labor relations contract. The War Labor Board demanded that both sides meet in Washington to end the walkout. Strike leaders defied the wartime no-strike pledge and ignored the international threat of disciplinary action. Strikers had the full backing of local UAW presidents. The UAW conceded that management had provoked the wildcatting through indiscriminate firings. Workers argued that if the War Labor Board prioritized production over union busting, they would order the reinstatement of all the discharged leaders. The Flint Labor Council passed a resolution demanding that all CIO and other union representatives resign immediately from the War Labor Board. It considered the board as stacked against labor. Workers at Chrysler and Briggs would soon end their walkout with guarantees of arbitration for reinstatement of the fired militants.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. It's known as the Miracle on Ice. In 1980, the U.S. men's hockey team beat the Soviet team and went on to win gold at the Olympics in Lake Placid, New York. Now, the region itself has won gold. In September, the New York Olympic region earned LEED Gold certification from the U.S. Green Building Council. The rating has long been applied to buildings, but now entire cities and communities can become certified for sustainability. Eric Backus of Clarkson University helped the region with its application. He says participating communities measure their performance in key areas.
Whether that be greenhouse gas emissions or waste diversion rates or things like vehicle miles traveled per year per capita.
Then they set goals for improvement. Backus says the Olympic region will try to reduce how many miles people drive. That means finding ways to help visitors get to popular hiking spots without a car. For example, by creating connecting trails or offering a shuttle. Backus says the region's economy depends on the climate, and global warming will lead to more days without snow.
Those are days you're not having people skiing. Those are days you're not generating revenue to run these facilities.
So he says the region embraces environmental action. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Sidewalks get repaired, dead trees get cut down, there's sawdust in the air. You might think it's wonderful, life in such a place. It's not utopia, it's just election day, election day. Garbage trucks are everywhere, at the break of dawn. Visit all the houses at once, just like Santa Claus. It might be a miracle, who am I to say? It's mass myopia on election day, election day. Election day, it's not a day for promises. Election day, it's the one day things get. Be sure he has nice hair, 'cause when there's credit due, his face is everywhere. It's not unusual, it's all the same. From here to Topeka on election day, election day.
Everyone, election day, of course. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. Ken Barnes is our producer, and he picks the song Election Day because it is Super
Tuesday.
Election Day. Oh, you're not going to believe it. So when I was doing that stand-up with NBC News, I kept talking about, well, tomorrow when they vote. And he's going, no, Arnie, it's today. I'm like, oh, my God, it is today. I'm like, so, Anyway, pretty Election crazy. Day, great. Yeah, and actually, you know what I love about that song? Is it really sort of speaks to local government. That especially on Election Day when you're voting for your mayor and your city council and your school boards, it's a day where they say, see, we clean your streets. See, yeah. We pick up your garbage. See, we cut down that tree. Don't you love government? I mean, government delivers, you know, which is why I was saying for a long time that I thought that not a governor, but that even a mayor should be the next president of the United States because the buck stops there. I mean, when you listen to it, of course, yeah. Then I'm looking at Bloomberg going, oh, and then I'm looking at everybody else. But Bernie was a mayor. Okay.
Yeah.
Bloomberg was a mayor. Mayor Pete was a mayor. There is value to that experience as mayor because it really does, you connect policy to people. See, when you're in Washington, you make policy, but there isn't that same kind of connection. Even when you're a governor, there's still a bit of remoteness. But when you're a mayor, guess what? You understand what happens when they cut funding. You understand what happens when, you know, there isn't someone to pick up after the horrific tornado that just took place in Tennessee, because it has consequences for your people. Where do they go? How do they live? How do they survive?
But also picking up on that point you made about on Election Day, all the politicians come around and say, oh, we paved the streets. We did all these things that you want. Well, you know what? Trump and Republicans, who are always saying get the government off the backs of the people, well, now we got this coronavirus scare, and everybody says, come on, federal government, help us out here, do this, and a lot of other things. It's always when we need something, when we need help, they look to the federal government, but in normal times, they just trash it.
All right. So today is not about government responding in an appropriate manner, but it is about journalism and the media. So we spent the first half hour talking about the libel suit by Donald Trump against the New York Times. He will lose, but that's not the point. I think Donald Trump loves to be litigious. And now we're going to go to something that I didn't even know about. There's an organization called the Common Ground Committee. And I'm a good little doobie because I've been reading my Christian Science Monitor for decades, actually. I think I've told Linda Feldman this. She is the Washington bureau chief, that when I was a child, my father didn't read me like the green fairy tale book and the red fairy tale book. He read me the Wall Street Journal and the Christian Science Monitor. So, you know, what can I tell you? I've had a warped childhood, which results in a warped 66-year-old. But it also means that I value the work and the effort of the Christian Science Monitor. And unfortunately, like everybody else in journalism, it has been challenged as they move into the future. But they still have Linda Feldman, which I so appreciate. And Linda was asked to moderate an amazing conversation. And the conversation was being put forward by the Common Ground Committee. It was done, I believe, at the Columbia School of Journalism. And it was entitled Facts, Fake News, and the Media. And it is described this way. In a time of intense political division, is it still possible for the public to turn to the media to gain a shred of understanding of facts, or maybe a shared understanding, a shred too, a shared and shred? A Common Ground Committee is a nonprofit organization dedicated to fostering civil public discourse. They invited the reporter Maggie Haberman from the New York Times, Fox News correspondent Chris Wallace to the Columbia University School of Journalism, and my next guest had the privilege and the honor of actually moderating that fascinating, fascinating conversation. Welcome to the program, Linda. It's been a long time.
Hi, Arnie. Happy to be here.
So let's talk about the conversation, because in a lot of ways, we were just talking with Richard Toefel, who is the president of ProPublica, about the lawsuit by Donald Trump against the New York Times, which obviously he will lose. But the point isn't winning or losing. For him, it's about sort of chilling the idea of people being able to offer either opinion or commentary about his administration, because you might be slapped with a lawsuit. The New York Times has deep pockets. It is more resilient. ProPublica is more resilient. But there may be a lot of other publications that will not be. And yet this is a time where he challenges us because there's a trust deficit with him. He lies more than anyone else. And his administration has done some horrific things. In fact, the thing that I thought was the most horrific that still sort of jumps into my mind is what I think began the conversation between Maggie and Chris Wallace, which was what happened to Mary Louise Kelly by Pompeo. And I think I would love to get your take on how this conversation was framed and what you took from these two very important people from very different sort of news outlets, one being perceived as uber conservative and the other one being the old gray lady as being sort of more moderate to liberal.
Right. So it was interesting when I was asked to moderate this panel, I didn't even see the need to find common ground because I see Maggie Haberman and Chris Wallace as both just straight news reporters, that they're not partisans, they're not liberal versus conservative. Right. But I was quickly corrected that there is a strong public perception that if you're a reporter for the New York Times, you're a liberal, and if you work for Fox News, you're very conservative and you're pro-Trump. And that in particular with regard to Fox, people in the public do not understand that Fox has a news division, and then they have the primetime department, and according to Chris Wallace, there's a firewall that they don't, that, you know, the primetime folks like Sean Hannity don't mess with what the news folks are up to. And I have had some people respond to some readers and some people who watch the forum say to me that they actually learned something by watching Chris Wallace speak and explain the difference between what he does and what, say, Sean Hannity or Laura Ingraham do.
So can I just stop you there? Because I understand that. And I've actually done – I've been on Fox News, not on their talk, more opinion shows. And I will tell you, you'll be very proud of me, Linda Feldman. When they challenge me on statements I make them fact-check me in real time. There, you'll love that. Anyway, because this is the opinion section, not necessarily the non-opinion section.
Right.
But I used to teach mass communications, and I would love to have been part of that conversation at Columbia School of Journalism. And here's what I taught my students. And I used – this is maybe decades ago, but it's still relevant to what Chris is saying and to maybe some extent what Maggie is saying. So you would get an AP story that would run. And papers get to pick up AP stories. That's how they do it, right? And what I noticed was there was something very interesting about the slant of the paper that picked up the exact same story, okay? So let's say there was a liberal lefty AP story for the Concord Monitor, my more liberal, moderate state news organization, and the Union Leader, which you know very well. And the Union Leader would do something interesting. Their headline would be toxic. Okay? And the headline of the Monitor would be maybe less toxic or maybe more receptive to Arnie reading it. Okay? So I would look at the headlines and I would show my students, notice the same story, look at the headline, and what do you think the story's about? And they would get really quiet. And I'd say, it's the same story. Wait a minute, Linda, it gets worse. I said, okay, what's the opening paragraph? Now remember, this is an AP story that's sent to everywhere in the country. They would use different paragraphs to open the story. All right? So I said, isn't this interesting? Same exact story, but look what they chose to open the story with, and look what they chose to open the story with. Okay? Now remember, this is the news section, not the opinion section. But obviously the owners of the paper made certain decisions as to who the headlines writer were. And then let me share something else. Where did the story get placed in the newspaper? And depending on the nature of the story, some, depending on the content, the Union Leader might like it on the front page. Or the Union might like it on the obituary page. So as someone who has taught mass communications, and I don't know how these, you know, Chris and Maggie would speak to this, but even though the straight news is straight news, and this is an AP story, so they weren't even involved in it. It's sort of generic in that way. Yet depending on the slant and the bias of who owns Fox and who owns the New York Times, you would even sort of get a different sort of context to the information given. And I'm wondering whether Maggie or Chris ever felt that they were sort of compelled to emphasize certain things, or they were given certain assignments because of what may be perceived as the bias of the ownership.
So I can't speak for either of them. And I'm, you know, I think you make an excellent point, which is that even in the realm of news coverage and editorial decisions regarding news, these are all run by people, and people do have biases,
they
have opinions about what is the correct news approach. And sometimes those decisions go to what gets covered and what doesn't get covered, not just the nature of the headline or the placement of the story, front page, interior page. So for sure, that kind of thing happens, and it happens everywhere. It isn't that, that CNN is a perfectly straight down the middle outlet in its news judgment, while Fox is way off on the right wing. I think for a lot of these, I think every news organization, I can't say every, for credible news organizations, there is an aspiration to be fair and unbiased,
and arm's length,
of course, in the eye of the beholder.
Exactly. So the title of the conversation between these two was Facts, Fake News, and the Media. So how did they talk about the challenge of Donald Trump, who is fact-challenged, who is suffering from a paucity of trust, who can say opposite things within 10 minutes of the same speech or press conference? How have they managed to cover him, and how do they figure out what to tell?
So that was perhaps that issue of how to cover Trump. That certainly they acknowledge that it's challenging, that he is an unusual president. I think we can all agree on that. And in fact, Chris Wallace made headlines when he spoke of an incident that had happened just that day. So the president was in India and had a press conference. And Jim Acosta of CNN, who is famous for being combative with the president, he asked the president a question, and the president came back with an attack on CNN, and Acosta attacked back.
I remember.
And he said something to the effect of, "Our record at telling the truth is a lot better than yours, Mr. President." And that was he was basically calling the president a liar. And so the issue there isn't whether the president lies or says stuff that isn't true. It's how do you, as a news reporter, respond to that kind of attack? Do you come back at him with an attack, which is what Acosta did? Chris Wallace and Maggie Agreed said that was not the appropriate way to approach the president. Chris said he was horrified by that, and that the idea isn't that you just, cower in the corner when the president goes after you, that you come back at him with facts. So the quote from Chris was, "It's not our job to get in fights with presidents. It's not our job to one-up presidents."
Okay,
it's our
so how do you
report on presidents?
Okay, so let me ask the question, here's my follow-up. Mm-hmm. So when the president says that, how do you then say, "But sir, may I correct the record?" I am trying to figure out because I don't want his stuff to land and it stick to me with Velcro, because the statement and the lie is really what people will then hear, since there is no response that appears to be permitted. So I guess I would like Maggie and Chris Wallace to give me I've got my stenography pencil out. I want to know, so how do you respond when what he says, in particular about the organization that you represent, is factually not accurate? How do you respond in a respectful way, but in a way that says, this is not an accurate representation of my organization?
So all I can do is tell you what I would have said. With all due respect, Mr. President, I disagree with your characterization, but can we get back to my question?
Okay.
So Jim Acosta had asked a legitimate, straightforward question, and that question was just lost in the shuffle when Trump decided to pick a fight. So I would just deflect. You can't get into a fact-check fight with the president in a press conference. I mean, CNN has an entire fact-checking team. The Washington Post, as I said at the forum, has chronicled over 16,000 misstatements, lies, what have you, since Donald Trump took office. So there's a whole industry of fact-checking around him, but you can't address this blanket assertion in a press conference where what you're trying to do is get specific questions answered.
Mm-hmm.
So that, I think that's the way to do it. Yeah,
but isn't that part of answering the question? I mean, if you ask him a question and his answer is the sky is purple, it's not accurate. And if he answers your question about what color is the sky and he says the sky is purple, he hasn't really answered your question.
He has answered your question, but the information is not accurate. Go on.
Right, but the question had nothing to do. Jim Acosta didn't ask Donald Trump, what do you think of the factual accuracy of CNN's reporting? It was about, I forget what the actual question was.
That's how sad this is. Yes, yes. and you're making your point. But you began the conversation at the Common Ground Committee meeting, which was everyone should watch. It's about an hour and 15 minutes. It's really worth it. And but you begin with NPR. And what happened with Pompeo and Mary Louise Kelly. And the reason why this is so shocking is that, you were kind of hoping that there would be some people within the administration that would still sort of understand and have respect for the media. What you saw with Mary Louise Kelly and Pompeo shook so many of us to the core, because it was beyond brutal. I mean, it was brutal. And I guess as you started with that, how did they respond to it? I just think it was, I mean, when he pulled out that map with no identifying countries and said to her, "Find me Ukraine," you want to look at him like, you are such a schmuck. And, and yet I'm just trying to figure out, what does that mean? Because this is not Trump. This is Pompeo. Pompeo graduated number one in his class. Pompeo has a resume, unlike Donald Trump, of being litigious and a liar, of being someone that people respected. But obviously, his brand of beating up on journalists, his brand of, you know, marginalizing the media and basically, you know, almost suggesting fake news, which is really what Pompeo was doing. How does a Chris Wallace and a Maggie Haberman, how do they discuss this in a public setting?
So I think I'm trying to think what they said. I can't remember exactly what they said, but I think the agreement within the press corps, the wider press corps, is that Mary Louise Kelly handled that incident absolutely correctly.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't lose her cool.
No.
She didn't start attacking the Secretary of State. She stuck to the facts. She was persistent without being unduly aggressive. Mm-hmm. I think Chris Wallace was envious that actually that Mary Louise Kelly had gotten an interview with Mike Pompeo,
right?
Because he's a pretty hot get.
Yeah.
So this is just, I think, a reminder that we Washington reporters have to be prepared if you're going to go into interview the Secretary of State or the President,
right,
or anybody in a senior position or anybody, period. You have to know what you're talking about, and you have to have ice in your veins and keep your cool. Because if you lose it, especially as a woman reporter,
yes,
if you lose your temper, that really damages your reputation. I mean, you have to behave professionally in that kind of setting, because it could really destroy you. Actually.
Well, and I'm going to go back to what I said. I was on this Fox Sunday show, and they challenged me on a statement. And again, I'm a female, so I'm going to relate in this way to Mary Louise Kelly, which is why, one, I don't utter something, especially, I mean, I don't utter something I know is factually incorrect, but especially on Fox, I have to be so overly prepared, it's like ridiculous. So when they challenged me, the reason I was calm and I said, fact check me now, please. Now, not later, because they basically said what I said was not true. I said, no, it's true. Check me now. And you should have seen, you know, so we went to a news break. It was, you know, a commercial break. And they came back and I said, and have you fact checked me? And in a lot of ways, it was a way of handling their accusing me of lying without basically getting into the mud and saying I'm not a liar. The best way of my saying I'm not a liar is to say fact check me. And
right.
And to a large extent, that's a little bit what I saw with Mary Louise Kelly.
Mm-hmm.
In a lot of ways, she basically said, fact check me, you know, which is why they took out, you don't know anything about Ukraine, you don't know anything. And of course she does, you know.
Yeah.
So she kind of fact checked them. But, you know, what for me is so fascinating is that you have two situations that just recently occurred. One occurred a while ago and one just occurred yesterday. So Chris Matthews was asked to walk away from MSNBC on Monday, and I saw it in real time. It was just kind of interesting. I, of course, have thought that he should have left about 5 years ago. But anyway, and I was glad to see it happen, but in a way thinking it had happened too late. And then I think about what happened with, isn't this, what was his name, Shep on Fox, where he walked away, but they walked away for very different reasons. One walked away because of, I think, the kind of requirement or content that was happening on Fox News, which I see all the time and I want to marginalize. And MSNBC asked Chris to sort of walk away because he had done things that were so over the top and inappropriate for a long time. And you can actually see it documented. This wasn't just last week or this election. It's been going on for a while. That it finally sort of came to a head and he was asked to leave. And I just find it so fascinating that these organizations are somewhat tone deaf to their responsibility to the public.
I don't know that Shepard Smith was asked to leave.
No, he walked away. He left. He left.
So he quit. I mean, he had had run-ins with Sean Hannity, and he had called Sean Hannity and the whole primetime lineup just entertainment and that it wasn't real news. And he just like, I'm out of here.
Right.
With Chris Matthews, it was, as you say, a very different circumstance. I agree, his sell-by date had passed a while ago.
Sell-by date. Yes.
And was really, frankly, hurting the brand. And I think it's, you know, too bad that it happened this way. But I think after his recent comment about Bernie, comparing Bernie to the Nazi takeover of France.
Right, and Hitler and Castro issues,
and
everything else.
Issues
and
with Stalin. Women, I guess that was the precipitating thing with the piece in GQ by Laura Bassett about Chris Matthews' inappropriate comments to her.
Right. And she documented a whole series of comments. And it wasn't a nice – I mean, Chris wasn't saying, oh, it's just because of me, you know. It's like she was able to sort of say there is a pattern and practice going on here. And actually, I also think that there was something that happened the week before when they were talking about South Carolina, and the Republican U.S. senator from South Carolina happens to be black. And he didn't know who he was and mixed him up with somebody else because all blacks look alike. Right. It didn't really help, you know. I mean, that was just another example of the fact that there is sort of – and let me just say something. So I am – looking at what happened with Chris, and to a large extent, we have a problem with some of the older generation who are sort of in these word ruts and these political ruts and these ideology ruts. And that's not just true with, you know, I mean, Chris Matthews had a real problem with it. Less so Joe Biden, less so Bernie Sanders, less so Mayor Bloomberg. But there's an interesting theme going on with all four of these men.
Right.
And it is both generational and not realizing that there is a necessity to be woke, especially at a time of urgency and change, given what Donald Trump has done to the discourse and the lack of trust in what's coming out, both of the media as well as government. Yes, I know,
Ken. I just want to say one thing. Wokeness is certainly one thing that the media needs to have. But the other thing, I think this Chris Matthews example is a perfect example of what I interjected with before. It's not the sky is green. What he said was essentially that Bernie Sanders is the same thing as Stalin and the Nazis. And Chris made this ridiculous comment, you know, they would be hanging me in Central Park if Bernie's elected. And it's like he was just so over the top, and that has to be reined in. The media does that kind of thing all the time, maybe not as over the top as Chris Matthews did that time, but there needs to be a way to rein the media in.
And Linda, at some point, I want to have you back because there are so many conversations we have to have, and I'm so you're so valuable as a moderator and a thoughtful person. But we are now living in the world of Twitter. We're now living in the world of 24/7 cable news. We're now living in the world of social media. And that has just challenged us in ways I think we haven't yet figured out what our footing is. And I think that's, to a large extent, sort of the problem that both Maggie and I suspect Chris also saw.
Yeah, and I know we have to run in a second, but that was another interesting part of our conversation was their differing approaches to Twitter. Maggie Haberman is on Twitter all the time, and Chris Wallace doesn't even have an account. He never looks at Twitter.
I love it.
And she's had Twitter feuds with the president. She says she always regrets it. Donald Trump goes after her on Twitter, and then she responds, and she always regrets it.
So let's take a page from Chris and Wallace, and maybe we'll all abandon Twitter, but can we and still be journalists?
Well, I think you can. I don't think you have to be on Twitter. You have to know the important tweets, but you can sort of sift. Twitter can be a huge time suck. You can just waste your time.
And I need to let you go. Oh, I don't want to let you go. Oh, I love you. I love you. Linda Feldman, Christian Science Monitor, Washington Bureau Chief, thank you so much for joining us. I value your voice. And again, thank you for coming on the air.
Sure. Good to talk to you, Arnie.
All right. Ciao. And we end with
Hypocrites by Jimmy Cliff.
Of course.